Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. Hey, good evening, everybody. Welcome once again to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. I'm Willie Hassel, along with the lovely, the mystical, the mysterious. Ooh. Ouch, that hurt. Lynn Nickerson. Good evening. How are you?
Good evening, Willie. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Hey. I didn't hurt your ears, did I?
You did.
I'm sorry.
That's why I said that hurt.
I wasn't paying attention.
Nah, I know it. Hey, that's okay. I'll live. I'll survive.
Good.
And I will not waste any more time, because tonight we have a great guest. Tonight on Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, we have a very special guest, Maddie Blake. He is an actor, host, and writer. He started out on the comedy stages of Boston and from there moved to New York City, where he quickly started his career as a working actor. Recent credits include Alpha House, Boardwalk Empire, How to Make It in America, and 30 Rock. Maddie has appeared on, there it is, Comedy Central. I lost my place. Comedy Central, VH1, ESPN, and many, many more. He has starred in over 20 national commercials and has a successful career in voiceover. He is the co-host, along with Ronnie LeBlanc, of the very successful Monsterland podcast. But tonight, Maddie is here because he is also the host of the History Channel's Drilling Down, The Curse of Oak Island. Let's welcome to Spirit Radio, Maddie Blake. Good evening, Maddie. How are you?
Hi, Maddie.
That's the greatest introduction I've ever had, except for one time I had to introduce myself.
Oh, we've done that before.
yeah, we've been there, too. You know, I could only use about half of your credits, though, in the intro, or else we would have been here all night.
Well, it sounds more impressive than it felt along.
So you got your start in comedy pretty much, didn't you, Maddie?
Yeah, I totally did. I was actually a criminal justice major. I wanted to be a police officer.
No!
Child. Yeah. And I was actually working to that end, and my brother signed me up for an open mic contest, you know, stand-up comedy night, and I won it. And
you're kidding!
Right there. It's started a whole path that, you know, ended me here.
So what is it? You used to joke around with the family, and then your brother put you in that embarrassing position, and you just aced it.
Yeah, kind of. I was like a fan of comedy, but I just never saw it as a, being from Massachusetts, I never saw it as a path for me. I was kind of not that intelligent. You know, I didn't know where you could pursue.
But comedy, stand-up comedy is difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it just seemed like a dream, something that happened in Hollywood. Or I never thought of it for me, but I always did say, you know, if I did stand up, I would say this, or I would do this impression or this. And so it just kind of, I was a fan of it, and my brother's like, you should try it. And I was like, no. And then he signed me up one night, and I did it, and I was good at it right out of the gate.
Unreal. That is so cool.
But along the line of criminal justice, you did get to do some, because now you arrest people on TV.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, played a lot of cops.
You played a lot of cops over the years, huh?
Yes, I have. I guess, you know, maybe there's something to that that's a little more, you know, on a cellular level, that we kind of play best what we know best, or what we want to be or to be.
Yeah.
I also think I have kind of a baby face, and I got a lot of roles as rookie cop. You know what I mean? It just kind of worked.
I thought you were going to say babies. You got a lot of roles as babies. Well, no, that you wouldn't qualify.
No, that's just because you're so young. That's all.
Yeah.
So you never did get to be a cop, though, right?
Well, not quite. I worked with high-risk children, high-risk youth in the city of Boston. I worked for something called the Governor's Task Force Against Drugs, which was an alliance created by the governor at the time. This was early mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting to try and get a federal job while I did that job, working basically for the Department of Youth Services with troubled kids and hoping I could get on a federal job. And right in that time is when I was living in downtown Boston and started my comedy career. And then after a while, I was making as much doing comedy as I was in my state job. So it was a pretty easy decision at that point.
And you were having a lot more fun, too, I bet.
Yeah, 100%. That job was all the credit to the people that do it.
Tough.
I don't think I would have had the stomach for it, yeah.
Like the hard work with those kids.
What club was it you started out in? Do you remember?
I do remember. It was called Remington's in downtown Boston. It was called The Vault. It was a former bank.
The Vault.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
okay.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
It was a former bank downstairs, and they used to have stand-up there. I don't know. They still may, but it was like a Catch a Rising Star New Talent Night or whatever. The reason it happened so fast for me was that I won it, quote-unquote, based on, you know, audience applause, basically. And the next day at work, the guy who was hosting it called me and said, we want to start using you. You want to host a show tomorrow night?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was just off to the races, yeah.
Wow.
You just never know what curve life is going to throw you, do you?
Yeah, just an overnight success, right?
Gee whiz.
Then I had to learn how to do it. That was the bad part. I actually learned how to do it. And those years were my, that was my schooling. You know, living in downtown Boston, I started to live more of a bohemian or artist life, you know, and turned over the day job and fully committed myself to, you know, arts and entertainment. And that's when the shift happened. Those 4 years, 5 years in downtown Boston were my school years.
Hmm.
Wow. That's a tough nut to crack. That's really risky. Very brave of you to do that.
Well, I don't know.
But it worked.
It just was something that happened. And yeah, I will say, I would never say brave, but I would say once I did make the flip, the mental flip, I treated it seriously. I didn't take myself seriously ever, but I treated it as a craft and I wanted to get better. I wanted to learn from people who were doing it in and around Boston. I had some great mentors and I fully, you know, put myself into it.
Yeah, there's one way to be professional and not professional, and you really have to be professional. You have to work on that. They just won't take you seriously.
Yeah, being funny is hard work.
Well, I've already said that.
It is.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
It is.
Right. You know, it does take thought, and some of the smartest people I know are some of the funniest people I know.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, to have a really quick wit and acerbic wit, it really takes intelligence, and I don't think people realize that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I did want to ask you then, we want to get into your paranormal experiences a little bit, but I'm interested in how you wound up getting in drilling down.
Yeah, so the Oak Island connection with me came because of my work in hosting. I had been doing hosting, and I was in New York City for about 15 years, and doing a lot of hosting and commercials, as it said in my bio, on film and television. And I had worked with this one producer at VH1 who had friends of his that went on to work on The Curse of Oak Island on History Channel the first couple seasons. And when they had determined that History Channel, that they wanted to do an extra content show, that the show needed more, they sent out, you know, the alert to casting people in and around New York and L.A., and my buddy was approached by those friends of his that were at Oak Island, working on Oak Island. They said, "Hey, do you know anyone who would be a good host for this thing? And if it might help if they're into kind of, you know, maybe alternative news or paranormal type stuff." And he was like, "Oh my God, Matty is the guy." And so he forwarded my name to them. And some of them, actually, a couple of them had remembered me from working, you know, with VH1 and doing some other stuff.
So mm-hmm.
I went in and auditioned just like a normal audition and, you know, beat out some, it was one of those weird, rare instances in the business where the right guy got the job in a way, because there were some big names that they were looking at, you know, in the hosting world.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, I'm never going to get this. They've got this guy in here and this guy in here. But my passion for it, you know, superseded whatever lack of a name I had, and it was sincere. You know, I was passionately interested in this type of thing. So I just got the job.
had they already had the show developed? Did they know where they were going with it?
Well, the show itself, The Curse of Oak Island itself, was in season two, my first season. So in other words, the show had become such a success that it warranted an extra content show.
Okay.
So drilling down, at first was a studio show. That first season, my first season, which is now 4 years ago, which is hard to believe,
wow,
going into my fifth season this year. That first season, it was a studio show where after every episode of The Curse of Oak Island, we would come on in studio and I would have the cast with me. And we would just, you know, in front of a live studio audience, a small live studio audience, just do a studio show, an interview show with clips and pre-produced packages. Over the seasons, it's changed. We've made it more into like an embedded journalist being on the island.
Yeah.
Specials. Yeah. So it's changed, and I'm happy with the change.
And Curse of Oak Island, of course, is one of the most popular programs on TV right now, and so I'm sure a lot of people have questions. And if you would like, you can text them to us at 603-430-9722.
Okay, so can you touch on some of your paranormal experiences, Matty?
Absolutely. Yeah, it started for me as a kid. I grew up in an environment where my grandmother would talk about prophetic dreams that she had and that her mother had back in Ireland, predictive dreaming. And my grandmother also said she had a ghost in her kitchen. She named it Bridget. She would talk to the ghost like, "Not today, Bridget." And Bridget would do things like knock pictures off the wall and, you know, cause all kinds of havoc. And, and also just growing up an Irish Catholic kid in Boston, you know, biblical stories and the saints and, you know, the things that we believed were really supernatural. I mean, if you read stories in the Bible, supernatural encounters, really. So I grew up with it. And then when I was about 10 years old, the first kind of lightning bolt of paranormal that really struck into my life, there was two, and they both happened around the same year. I think I was 9 or 10. The first one was I got very sick. I had like a bronchial infection or something, and I basically had what would be an outer body experience. I wasn't close to death, but I was feverish. And you know the kind of stucco white plaster on your ceiling of your room? I was nose to nose with it.
Uh-huh.
And then I spun around, I turned around and could see my body in the bed.
As a kid, oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I immediately like kind of sucked back into my body, and I was so frightened by that. And then shortly after that, I had a dream about a pet I had. I had a beloved pet parakeet. I loved this thing. And I had a dream that I took it to school, and it was a very vivid dream, one of the most vivid dreams I've ever had in my life. And in the dream, the bird escaped, and then I was running through the halls all frantic, and I found the bird, and it was dead in my dream.
Mm.
And I woke up in a panic, and relieved I was just having a dream, and I ran over to his cage, and he was dead on the bottom of his cage.
Oh.
And that made me remember my grandmother's stories about these predictive dreams. She had dreams when people were going to pass. Her mother had dreams when people were going to pass. So that really affected me. As a matter of fact, it scared me, and I kind of swore it off at that point, to tell you the truth. I didn't want it. I was like, nope.
Yeah, really.
Get it off of me.
That kind of started me off. And then in my 20s, I saw a full body apparition, what I believe to be a full body apparition. So, yeah, it's been kind of a big part of my life for a long time.
How about little people? Did your grandmother believe in or see or communicate with little people?
With little people?
Yeah, like elves, they call them the little people. Pretty much.
Yeah, no, that's that is one thing I haven't had personal experience with. But someone just posted something the other day about a little person caught on a. I don't know if you guys saw that on a video camera, a screen grab. It's been kind of making the rounds.
No,
I didn't see that.
Yeah, I'll try and send it to you guys. It's a really cool shot.
I'd like to see that.
None of that contact that I know of. Probably back in Ireland. there were stories about that, but I wasn't aware of them.
That's why I was wondering. Maybe your grandmother was privy to that or believed in it. Okay, then, getting to Oak Island and drilling down. Before we get anything into anything paranormal, I did want to touch on some of the artifacts and the structures that were found there. And I'm curious to know what you think about whether or not activity was going on there, especially from the Europeans, previous to the 1795 figure, because they did come across that medieval cross. And I'm not talking about the cross that the McGinnis sisters had, but the medieval cross. What do you think?
Yeah, so there's, in my opinion, there's no question now. This team has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that works were going on the island pre-1795, in other words, pre-Money Pit. So for those of your audience that might not know, the Oak Island story basically starts in 1795 with the discovery of the Money Pit, the so-called Money Pit.
Right.
And since then, people have been trying to figure out, you know, what is searcher, in other words, people looking for the treasure, looking for the money pit, and what is pre-1795, in other words, depositor. And this team keeps finding things that get older and older and older.
Yeah.
And this medieval cross that was found late last season has dated to be medieval. It also attests to come from a quarry in Europe, which I think ceased operations in the 14th century. So, you know,
14th century.
Yeah, like we're talking 700 years old, you know?
Wow.
You know, there's no question in my estimation that something very old. And then the dendrochronology, the wood dating of the things they found in Smith's Cove, which is near where the money pit is, or we believe the money pit to be, has dated with a 99.9% accuracy to be pre-1795. So that means that pre-discovery of the money pit, people were building things, structures in Smith's Cove. I think absolutely things were going on there before 1795, and I think this team has proved it.
Well, they also found those sluice-type structures. One was a U-shape, one was L-shaped, and one was straight. I guess they were made out of logs or boards, but the structures sort of indicated that they were trying to control the flow of water. And I got to thinking, you know, in mining operations, that's what's used. Do you suppose that pre-1795 they might have been mining something?
It's a definite possibility. Yeah, I mean, anything's a possibility, but the odd thing is the earliest records we have of that, you know, area of Oak Island indicate, from the people that were looking for the money pit, from the earliest searchers, indicate a series of box drains, which all funneled into one pathway, which was specifically made to flood the money pit with water. And what this team is finding seems to fit. They're finding these stoned, lined kind of finger drains, if you will, box drains, if you will. So there's also, but they're also, to your point, they're finding strange walls that they can't explain. They're even finding, they found a cement wall, which is absolutely bizarre. They found some stuff late this season that they couldn't test. So, yes, they could be mining. The answer is kind of like yes and, in a way. Anything is possible. We don't know what they were doing. Smith's Cove has turned up to be, every time they put a grab into the earth, they find something.
Gee whiz, that's just amazing. It's just full of mystery.
Really,
and every time they find something, they find a new question.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. I just said the other, I was doing some press for last night's finale, and someone was asking me about the theories. Well, do you think it's pirates? Do you think it's British military? Do you think it's the lost works of William Shakespeare?
Yes, all of the above.
Templar. And I basically said, well, yeah, kind of. This team has found evidence that points to every single one of those theories.
Well, what do you think about the ship that they suspect to be buried in the swamp? What do you think that might have been about?
Well, that was the most exciting. That was the most exciting thing I've ever been part of, besides the cross. But what was thrilling last night, if anyone got to see the special, was that we received results while I was in the room, live time, you know, live on tape, from Eagle Canada, which revealed an anomaly in the swamp. Now, I have to back up a little bit and tell you that Fred Nolan, one of the original
postmodern
searchers, a surveyor on Oak Island, believed that it was a Spanish galleon ship operation. There was a Spanish galleon that was sunk into a man-made swamp and then kind of dammed in. That was his belief. And he found parts of a ship during his searches in the swamp. So to find an anomaly that when you see it on the computer screen in front of me, everyone in the room, Marty Lagina was the first one. He kind of spelled it out. He was joking, like S-H-I-P. And I just said it. I go, that's a ship. It looks like a ship to me. You know?
Was that ground-penetrating radar that you were looking at that said that, indicated that?
Seismic testing. Yeah, they used explosions, small TNT explosions that send seismic pulses basically down on the ground and read by geophones, and they take that data and lay it down on a three-dimensional grid. It's really incredible technology.
So it's almost the same principle, sending rays down that bring back a picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh, so it really did look like a Spanish galleon?
It did to me. I mean, put it this way, it's long. It looks like a ship on its side. Now, could it be a natural anomaly? Absolutely.
Possible.
It could be. But I asked I was very careful to ask those Eagle Canada guys. They know what they're doing. This is what they do for a living. And I said, what about that to you makes you excited about it? And they just said, it does not seem to be a natural, as we usually see them, it doesn't seem to be a natural formation. It just, nature doesn't shape things like this seems to be shaped.
Or it could be a long dugout canoe, but probably not.
It's pretty long.
It's pretty long.
It'd be a pretty big canoe, huh?
A pretty darn big canoe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the first paranormal events that happened was about 1795, when Daniel McGinnis saw the lights in the woods, and he and his friends chased after them. Which led to the discovery of the pulley and the ground indentation. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, if you know anything?
Yeah, the story is that the Oak Island tale begins, although it doesn't really begin, but it begins in terms of the treasure hunt, the modern treasure hunt, 1795, Daniel McGinnis and his friends. The way it was described was anomalous lights, strange lights. Now, we don't know. I mean, that could lead you down a path into thinking about UFOs or something, or it could be just strange, you know, torches. We don't know, but it was enough to get them to head over to this island, which, by the way, already had a bit of a reputation in the area as a strange place, as a place where maybe there was pirates, treasure, things like that. So a young man seeing strange lights on the island rushes there. They get there and they see an indentation in the ground. They dig. At exactly 10 feet, they find wooden platforms, clearly man-made. Every 10 feet thereafter, they hit same platforms. They're described as kind of wooden logs, if you will, laid, splayed flat. And, you know, they could only dig so far, and then they gathered some money and some people, and they kept digging. And at 90 feet, they found a stone, which has become known as the 90-foot stone, which had strange carvings carved into it, almost hieroglyphics. It was translated as possibly reading something to the effect that below this is 40 million pounds lie buried. So at that point, they kept digging, and that's when it flooded with ocean water, and here we sit today. Now, what's interesting about the when we bring up anomalous lights is it's not the last time that people have seen strange lights in and around Oak Island. And in fact, I interviewed Dave Blankenship, who lives on the island, the son of the late now Dan Blankenship. And we did a paranormal special, actually, and he admitted that he saw a ball of fire. Those are his words, coming across Mahone Bay over the water towards the island. He got a call from a friend saying, you better get your dad. You guys better get over there. The island's on fire, is what he said. So he sped onto the island and got there, and there was nothing. He said it was a ball of fire going straight across Mahone Bay, slowly, like a sun, a flaming sun, and it moved its way towards the island, and by the time I got down the causeway and around to the island, where it would have been, it was gone. So, you know... You tell me. I don't know what that is, and I don't know how to explain it, but it is certainly added to the tales of strangeness on Oak Island.
Do you know what year that happened? Was that when he was a kid? In the 70s.
1970s, yeah.
Oh, that's strange. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, it was a bombshell for me, too. He had mentioned it on the studio show, and... season one, because I look back on the tapes and he definitely said, as a matter of fact, if you do a Google search, you might be able to find that clip, you know, Dan Blankenship, I don't know, coming down UFO or whatever, but it's there. He did say it, but we didn't really pursue it because at that time we weren't really getting into the paranormal aspects of the island as much because it was so early in the show's run and it was really, you know, we didn't want it to become a paranormal show because it's not strictly right. a paranormal show. But now, I mean, look, the name of the show is The Curse of Oak Island, so we get into more of that.
You know, those anomalous lights in the woods, they're kind of similar to reports of Will-o'-the-Wisp, that they're supposed to be lights or spirit lights that either lead you astray or lead you to something. So it's not the first I've heard of that, but it's great that it led them to a location and that there was something there.
Isn't that cool?
It is.
Cool
it really thing. Is. And before we... go. We're almost at the bottom of the hour, but I wanted to ask you, those platforms, do you suppose they were structured to give strength above what they buried? Do you think that was the purpose?
Quite possibly. To me, it seems like more of a Solomon's Temple thing, where I've come to believe that it's a bit of a distraction. That that they 'cause that's what they used to do. They'd bury something like that. With platforms or whatever, and then the real treasure. So you would find it. You would spend all your time getting through these platforms and layers. You'd find some bit of treasure and think, aha, I've got it. But in reality, the real treasure is offshoot of that through a tunnel system somewhere else.
Wow, that's so labyrinthian, and it takes so much time.
Oh, yes. That's why I think it's more than treasure. I'll tell you my theory when we get back.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So we're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to take a break. We're talking to Maddie Blake, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away.
Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience with your hosts, Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson, on WSCA 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Welcome back to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. And I'm Willie Hassel, along with the lovely Lynn Nickerson. And tonight, our guest is Maddie Blake. Maddie is the host of the History Channel series, Drilling Down, The Curse of Oak Island. Welcome back, Maddie.
Welcome back, Maddie.
What a beautiful conversation. I love being on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you for
thank you for
joining
us. And while we're at it, I also want to thank you once again for that great presentation at the New England Parafest.
Oh, at the Parafest.
A couple
of weeks
ago.
That was wonderful.
So fun. I love doing those.
Oh, cool.
One of the best things about this whole gig is getting to go out and speak to people about Oak Island. I love it.
Yeah. I know the audience really enjoyed it, too.
So we are really curious about your theory on what those log layers were. You mentioned Solomon's Temple.
Yeah, Solomon's Temple could be a bit of a model for what went on Oak Island. I would never claim to say I know what's on Oak Island, but I do firmly believe with all my heart that I've always, from day one, felt a connection to the swamp, and I've felt a connection to the Knights Templar theory, meaning I don't believe that people would go through what they went through on Oak Island to bury gold and temporal treasure and rubies and things like that and money. Not to say that that hasn't been buried on Oak Island. I believe it has. But the true deep workings of Oak Island were done to hide something of religious or ethereal importance to a society or to a group. And so I think the founding of the medieval cross was an absolute
a significant find,
paranormal gift to this team that that keeps them going in that direction.
Do you think it could remotely have something to do with the Ark of the Covenant?
I think possibly. I think possibly Ark, more likely something a little smaller, maybe more in line with the chalice, something like that. But certainly, or maybe just some lost manuscripts or you know, kind of a Dead Sea Scroll type of situation. Because remember, too, this team has found pretty ancient paper and pretty ancient bookbinding and leather deep underground.
How ancient? So
what the heck is that doing there?
Have you got an idea of the century? Is it like a 11th or 12th century?
That the paper was, I don't think it's quite that old.
Okay.
It's old. It's old. It's the leather bookbinding was used, according to one expert, in, again, that Middle Age period, middle aged important documents like, like a Bible, like a version of a Bible in the Middle Ages would use this certain type of ink, and they would use that certain type of leather bookbinding. So again, we're back into the Middle Ages. We're talking again like Templar type of time.
So maybe 1200s to 1400s, somewhere in there?
Yeah, 14th century, 13s, 1400s, yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, the other odd thing that they found, which would actually reflect back on an earlier culture, do you remember that they found the stone head?
Yes, yes.
And it looks like a Native American head to me.
Oh, yeah, I can see that completely, yeah. There's the Mi'kmaq, there's a lot of Native American connection with that area in Canada. That brings us into Nolan's Cross, which is another huge find, again, by Fred Nolan, the guy I mentioned earlier, believes that the swamp has a Spanish galleon in it. He found in the 80s, I believe the early 1980s, I want to say 1981 maybe, he found the center stone to what has now been called Nolan's Cross. Nolan's Cross is a megalithic structure, giant stone cross that is smack dab basically in the middle of Oak Island. And the stones, the stone that he found, the center stone, is shaped like a human head, for lack of a better term.
That is remarkable.
It is remarkable. And I talked to an expert just recently on my podcast, and he's an expert in megaliths. He was talking about all the different reasons that people would have a megalith. Now, a lot of people have said that Nolan's Cross is an indication of where the money pit is or where the treasure is. But also, megaliths were done, these large stone things were done almost like an acupuncture on places in the earth where people who had the knowledge that knew were hot spots.
I've heard
of
that.
Energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a new thing I thought of, I was thinking of when I was listening to him. Like, maybe Nolan's Cross is more about the energy that's on Oak Island, because it absolutely has some strange things going on. You know, equipment always breaks on Oak Island. There does seem to be some sort of metaphysical, or even if it's not paranormal, but there seems to be some sort of, energy anomaly on Oak Island of some kind.
You know, it's very similar to, like, America's Stonehenge. A lot of these stone structures, they were cultural centers, and they were built with earth energies. And at America's Stonehenge, there is a headstone, a stone carved like a head. And that was typical of these megalithic sites, stone sites.
Wow, isn't that interesting? Yeah, and then here we have one on Oak Island, too.
Yes.
You're right.
It almost seems to me like perhaps there was a megalithic stone circle or something that might have had some religious significance.
Yeah, there's also been some people who have come on the island and given their theory about Nolan's Cross in terms of astrological connections.
Okay, that too.
Correspondence to Virgo and you know, an astrological connection, which is very interesting as well.
And exactly what is Nolan's Cross? Is it the head, or are there other stones there? Is it the head that's at the center of the island?
Well, it's not quite the center of the island, but it's stones laid out in a cross.
So it's
individual stones laid out in a huge megalithic cross pattern. So if you lit each one of them at night and looked from above, you would see a giant cross on Oak Island, which is pretty incredible to think about.
Mind blowing. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, right?
Wow. Okay, so let's get into the paranormal stuff. Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. So what have you experienced, Maddie?
Yeah, so...
Or heard about?
A bunch of things. I mean, look, it's a unique place. It's a special place. And if you are like we are, if you're listening to the show, and you guys obviously and me, we tend to... have one foot always in things that we can't explain. Mm-hmm. Or both feet. Well, if you're open to that type of thing, Oak Island is a great place for you to visit and go to. I've had all kinds of things happen from day one, where I almost feel like I was fated or destined to be part of this story, like to somehow be involved with it.
And,
you know, like when I talk about beating out those big names and things like that, it's an almost impossible journey that I'm here, but I'm here and I just feel connected to it. And there's things involved with my mother's passing that have to do with the island that I won't go into, but very personal, deep connections to the island that I know came from the other side. And then things just that I've experienced on the island, like just recently we did a paranormal special this season, and me and Brian Kano did an EVP session, and we got some responses.
Wow.
And I played them back for Rick and Marty. One of them, at one point, I was calling down into one of the holes in the ground, and I called out, what do you want us to do? And the caisson banged from way down in underneath us very loudly, and the water didn't move, so nothing was dropped in or anything like that. No one kicked it. It was from way down below where we were standing above it. And then we started getting EVPs. Rick and Marty heard, when Brian asked, who are you or what is your name, they heard the name Jason. Brian thought it was saying chain them, which is frightening because there's a large theory that a lot of people believe that whoever built the tunnels, when they were a common practice, was to chain a slave down when you were done as a curse. So, you know, there's that aspect. People see a black mass. I've never seen the black mass, but I have been on the island at night and had a very, very bad feeling, you know, feeling like it's time to go, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's beyond just it's dark out.
It's like saturated evil.
Yeah, yeah, or a presence that, presence that's very protective of that area up by 10X. And 10X... Mm. is the hole that the late Dan Blankenship hand dug. And it is, he believed he saw a human body down there. And so a lot of weird stuff happens up by 10X. That's where people see the black mass. It was right down from 10X, probably just about 500 to 600 yards away, that Dave saw that fireball coming, approaching the island. So there's a lot. There's the tale of a guy named Kaiser, who was a local tough guy, worked on the island, fearful of no man type of guy, rough and tumble. Went to bed one night up and around right outside of 10X in the kind of rest hall shack area, and had a large creature, demonic type creature, pin him down, as he tells it, and say in no uncertain terms, you know, get out. He fled the island never to return. He would never set foot back on the island, and he had the scratch marks on his chest to prove his tale. So,
wow.
Yeah, these things are Fred Nolan, the searcher. I just found this out, actually. I didn't know this. Fred Nolan, the surveyor, who I've mentioned a few times now, he has a beautiful house on the island. He told Rick Lagina he never slept on the island. He never stayed overnight.
Really?
I was just going to ask you about that, yeah.
Wouldn't do it, because he felt like there were disembodied spirits. He felt like the crows were watching him. He felt the crows were the crows on the island, like the birds, were watching him, and that they were the kind of spirit animals of some.
Truly, I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible stuff. And these guys were not, you know, new age flighty crystals.
No, they're like from the old school.
Yes. So for them to say this so matter-of-factly carries a lot of weight with me. Dan Blankenship, the late Dan Blankenship, we just did the, you know, special to last night, told me he had a couple of paranormal experiences. And this guy is not, he's as, you know, salt of the earth as they come.
Right.
Well, you know, the totality of evidence is that Oak Island is a place that is a bit of a hotbed for this type of activity.
When did Dave pass away?
Just a few months ago. A couple months ago. Gosh, I don't know. We just did that. I was just there at the funeral.
Oh, that's so sad. I saw the show where he talked about he almost died once, but they forgot to tell him that he wasn't supposed to die, so he gained consciousness again. I mean, he came very close to death before.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
He had come very close to death at one point, and he was unconscious.
Well,
and I can't remember what accident he had, but it was near fatal.
Oh, that one. Yeah, that was incredible. His son actually saved his life down 10X. The caisson collapsed around him, started to collapse. He got pulled up by his son, and he watched it, just these big steel caissons. Picture, if you will, it's a round former, it used to be a tanker car. You know, he's 100 and I don't know what he was at the time, maybe 160, 180 feet down there. And it starts to collapse. He gets pulled up in a, you know, heroic act by his son, and he watches it collapse below his feet as he gets lifted up.
Oh, my gosh.
That piece of caisson, by the way, is on display in the Interpretive Center on Oak Island, and it looks like if you just took a soda can, and an empty soda can, and crushed it in your hands, that's what it looks like. He would have been buried in steel 180 feet down if his son didn't act so fast.
Oh. Didn't he also have some kind of head injury, a serious head injury?
Dan?
Yeah.
Or are you thinking of Dave's big accident?
Dave Blankenship, I'm sorry, yes.
Dave, his son, was in a construction accident, a really bad one, and it caused him to have a stroke. And that's why he, if you notice on the show, he limps, and he has very little use of one side of his body. So, yeah, but he recovered fully. They thought he was a goner. Maybe that's what you're referring to.
I got the two of them mixed up.
Dave should have been, by all rights, a goner after that accident, but he survived.
So was it Dave that told you the other paranormal happenings to him?
Yes, Dave's the one who saw the fire blanket. In other words, Dan's son. But Dan himself, the father, told me that he had a couple himself, a couple unexplainable experiences, including a disembodied voice.
And what area?
I think he was standing not too far outside where the museum is now, kind of outside his house, when he heard it. And he said to his wife, "Did you hear that?" And he said he heard it as clear as day. And
what was said?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What was said? Was it get out?
No, it was something about, it was a predictive, it had to do with, believe it or not, it had to do with, like, politics, as I remember. Like, they were talking about a politician or something, and it just spoke to him clear as day. And then whatever it said came to pass, according to him. So, again, you can't explain these things. I don't know how to contextualize that. You know, it's just an incredible tale. And when it comes from someone like him, it really has a lot of credit.
Truly eerie. Well, then, what about the curse? Just in case someone doesn't know, would you mind telling us about the curse again?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't know a heck of a lot about it. The first time that the curse, and again, the show's called The Curse of Oak Island, but unfortunately, we don't know too much about it. The curse first appears in writing, or at least that we could find in any sort of real way, in a 1960s article about the island. Is quoted as a local woman saying the curse is that seven people must die in active pursuit of the treasure, so before the secrets can be revealed. Now, historians that we've checked with have said that curses were a very common thing to do when you're burying treasure.
Right.
Makes sense. You know, if you just say, oh, this land is cursed, and no one's going to go search it. You know? So that's kind of the history of it. But the kind of eerie thing is that if seven must die, six have died thus far in active pursuit of the treasure. So we're way past seven in terms of people who have worked on the island passing away, or who have something to do with the island passing away, some connection to the island passing away. But the spirit of the curse is that you die in active pursuit, in other words, while digging for treasure. And that number is six, as far as we know now.
And weren't there about five of them that died in 1965? Four or five?
There was a terrible incident. Yeah, the Restall incident. They all died in one horrible day.
Ooh.
In August.
Jeez.
And there's a monument to that. And that's actually where that happened, is just off to the right and probably only 100 yards from this area that I'm talking about up by 10X, where everybody sees the black mass and stuff. So that little part of the island, that eastern shore of the island, kind of heading up that way, is a lot of stuff happens up there.
Ooh. Hey, do you know if there have been any ghost investigative groups going in there, any little ghost hunters?
Yeah, season one, they actually had a team come up there, and there was kind of inconclusive. And then the next time that any sort of official, you know, thing like that happened was not until this past season on Drilling Down, when we brought out Brian Kano, and we did pretty thorough paranormal investigation, taking readings, meters. We did EVPs, and that was the only two times that I'm aware of.
So they did get EVPs and really no other evidence, no photographs of anything in particular?
No photographs. That would be next, though. I would love to do some something like that.
Yeah.
Next time. Maybe some, you know,
infrared
motion detectors, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What about the EVP? Not EVP. Electromagnetic.
Yeah, the MEL meter gave us some strange readings, but again, Oak Island is so weird with electromagnetic interference. And, you know, Oak Island is very famous for having people come on it and say, you know, workers with their equipment, and just brag about how this piece of equipment cannot fail. It never fails. It's got a backup to the backup system, and it's all computer. And then they set foot on the island, and the thing just dies. And they go, I don't know how this has happened. It happens all the time. And,
wow.
And the team always goes, welcome to Oak Island. So we couldn't really gain a lot off that because it's so wild. It's hard to get a base reading on Oak Island.
Yeah.
Right. There is no normal on Oak Island.
Well, it's almost as if the island is being protected by a certain faction or group or mindset, entity mindset. Don't you feel that, Maddie?
It does feel that way. It feels like the island gives this team just enough to say, you know, we think you're the guys and keep going, but every time they find, every time it seems like they're going to solve it, it goes away. And then they're about to give up and they're all frustrated and they find another little thing. And then that goes away. And it's just really, it does feel like it's being protective. It feels like it's going to give us, it feels like it's going to reveal to us its secrets when she wants to.
Yeah. It amazes me that they haven't been, stopped short before now.
Right. Yeah, it's every time, like I said, every time they feel frustrated, they find a little something in it, and it invigorates everybody, and they keep going.
The McGinnis sisters again. What do you think about what they had to say about finding three treasure chests?
Yeah, I mean that's incredible. And then there's so many tales about that period and the kind of descendants of McGinnis, and you know, people like Samuel Ball, who was a former slave and cabbage farmer, and ends up somehow being one of the wealthiest guys in the area.
Yeah, makes you wonder.
Portion of the island, yeah, and a large bit of property in Nova Scotia. And I don't know if you know anything about slavery, but not a lot of former slaves were buying a lot of land. So what happened that he became so wealthy so fast?
Yeah, kind of an indication there, isn't there? Mm. Really lucky guy.
There's a story about the around that time of one of the crane operators, or one of the guys working on the drilling operation, picked something up, put it in his pocket. They said, "What is it?" He said, "Oh, nothing." And he left the island and started buying property all over Nova Scotia.
What was it, a cougar rand?
That's been a legend for a while.
That's amazing. Just one piece, one piece of silver or whatever.
That's what they say.
And they've also connected, a British button?
Yeah, now here's a cool little thing, too. One of the other big theories that Fred Nolan had was that, the late Fred Nolan, is that it was a British military operation. And as soon as he died, I think within 24 or 48 hours after he died, the team found conclusive evidence of a British military encampment, basically on the shore of the island, right when you come on the island, right over the causeway off to your right. And it included British military coins, buttons, military pins. They found a tag, which is what they call the ball tag, which is Samuel Ball. They think it might have been a musket tag or somehow his name written on it. So indication of a British military operation. I just thought that was really amazing that they found that right after Mr. Nolan passed.
Yeah, he had some pretty accurate ideas of what was going on there, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a smart guy. He was a
truly
surveyor. And you look at his maps, man, it's like that movie A Beautiful Mind. It's just like unbelievable detail. There wasn't a part of that island besides where Dan wouldn't let him go on his property. But other than that, there wasn't one bit of that island that he hadn't surveyed.
Wow, that's a good analogy. What do you think the period was of the British occupation there? Early 1700s or later?
Yeah, 1700s, exactly right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
18th century, yep.
And let's get back to the galleon for just a second. Why do you suppose they buried the galleon? Or sunk it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be a great way to quickly, if you have tons of treasure, like literally tons, what a brilliant way to make your own bank vault, but to kind of, to hide a treasure, if you will, to vault it underground is just, instead of loading it off a ship, you sail the ship into a man-made
big lagoon,
which is
kind
a swamp. Yep, you fill it with water, you turn it on its side, and you sink it, you submerge it. You know exactly where it is, you can access it, no one else is going to find it, and it's buried right under the surface of the swamp.
But what happens? I mean, the stuff like that, you get silt and whatnot and build up. How would you access it? I mean, you can hardly access it now.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the other question, too, is do you want people to find it? Do you want to be able to get to it? You know, gold isn't going to rot, so it buys you some time if you wanted, if you needed to leave it there for a time and kind of have it be a community bank. If you know where to go, if you know exactly where to go, you could access it. I mean, it is mucky and stinky, but you can access it. And, you know, if that's what they did, we don't know that's what they did, but all signs are kind of pointing in that direction right now. And, you know, maybe it's something that wasn't supposed to be retrieved.
Yeah, you might be right, but it seems like an awful lot of trouble to go to.
It does.
For that. And were you going to say, well...
Oh, I was just going to say that we're just about out of time.
Okay, one quick question about the hinge. It's supposed to have been found on a treasure chest.
One quick question.
What do you think about that?
I'm sorry.
The hinge that they found that...
Yes.
I forgot the doctor's name, but she thought that it had been found, there found on treasure chests.
Yeah, that those type of hinges were on treasure chests.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we know, that one expert, we don't know which treasure chest, we don't know who, we don't know when or where, but it's just another piece of the Oak Island puzzle. That, okay, there seem to be treasure chests here, too, at some point.
That came from the money pit, didn't it? Or did it?
That particular?
Yeah.
Money pit area, potentially. I'm not sure exactly which hinge you're talking about, but yeah, money pit area. We don't know exactly where the money pit is.
Okay.
Officially, yeah.
Okay, well, we are out of time, Maddie. There is going to be, because of Oak Island Season 7, is there going to be a drilling down Season 7, new season?
Indeed.
Oh, right. Wonderful. We're glad to hear that.
Excellent. Maddie, we thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Real pleasure.
Thank you, guys. What a blast. Anytime you need me, I'll be there for you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And do you have a website or anything you want to give out?
Yeah, so you can go to MattieBlake.com or you can reach me on all social media at the Maddie Blake.
Okay.
All right.
Very good.
Thanks so much, Maddie. We enjoyed it.
Thank you,
Maddie. Have a good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. The Curse of Oak Island. Fascinating.
I don't know if I'd even want to go there.
Sure you would.
I don't know.
Oh, sure you would.
It sounds dangerous to me.
Sounds dangerous. Okay. Hey, that's Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience.
And once again, thank you everyone for listening, and you have a good evening.